Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. We know where we are. The question is, where are we going? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Risnall. It is the 23rd of September today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our starting point on this Thursday in late September of another plague year is our economic present. Our destination is our medium-term economic future. The Federal Reserve and economists more broadly see an economy that is, yes, still growing quite nicely, recovering well from the deepest depths of the pandemic downturn. But the pace of that recovery now just isn't as strong as it was just a couple of months ago. Guesses about economic and jobs growth have been dialed back a notch or two, and there are, well, some obstacles in our path. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman today takes up his post once again at our desk of economic peril to look at what could wind up getting in our economic way.
Make no mistake, the Fed and most economists don't see a stallout or recession coming soon. The wild card, says Joseph Bruzuelas at consulting firm RSM, is COVID. The Delta variant and any new variants
could cause consumers to pull back, business to slow. I'm out on the road on business travel again. The airplanes are half full and the hotels aren't full.
Job growth has already slowed, says Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute.
We added over 700,000 jobs a month for 6 months in a row earlier this year, but then Delta hit, and we added only about a third that amount in August.
Then there's global supply chains, disrupted by COVID outbreaks, driving up prices. There are increasing troubles in China's real estate market, but Eric Friedman at U.S. Bank Asset Management isn't too concerned.
We're not anticipating a significant contagion effect from the issues in China right now. They have a significant set of reserves to allay some of these concerns.
Closer to home, a political risk is looming, says Joseph Bruzuelas, if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling and the U.S. defaults.
That's a politically induced artificial crisis. There is a cost. You'll see equity sell off. You'll see consumer and corporate confidence erode.
Bruzuelas says this is right at the top of the Fed's worries about the recovery going forward. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We talked a little bit yesterday about the Fed, as Mitchell was talking about, giving every sign that it's going to start slowly, ever so slowly, easing up on some of the support it has been giving this economy. Tapering, as we explained, its bond buying program, perhaps as soon as next month. And then, maybe, if all goes well, nudging interest rates up. As always, the pandemic and our response to it plays a big role here. But this is the start of the process lots of economists and businesses and investors have been watching and waiting for and forecasting around. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has today's story in a genre that we have come to call What Happens Now?
Not much really changed yesterday, but Fed Chair Jerome Powell laid out a clear picture of what the change, when it comes, is going to look like. Jamie Cox is managing partner of Harris Financial Group in Richmond, Virginia.
Yesterday, I think the Federal Reserve did a very good job of, you know, setting a boundary between what taper meant and what liftoff will mean.
The conditions necessary for winding down support compared to the more stringent conditions for actually raising interest rates. So for now, consumers may only notice slight changes in, say, the housing market, says Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin.
The window for which mortgage rates are at record lows is narrowing and could be over quite soon. In the short term, that could actually encourage more people to buy a home or to speed up their home search.
If all goes according to the Fed's plan and the economy continues to stabilize, eventually interest rates for things like credit cards and personal loans could start moving up too. However, says Jack Kleinhens, chief economist for the National Retail Federation,
it's hard to know where the economy or what the economy will look like in the middle of next year and whether or not the pandemic is contained.
So while the Fed has laid out the path that could get us to higher interest rates, Kleinhens says it's starting with baby steps. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Man, there were a whole lot of what ifs in the last 4 minutes of this radio program, huh? Wall Street today, traders were looking to buy, but also we'll tell you about bonds. Interesting news there, as usual. Details, numbers, you know the drill. It was about 5 weeks or so ago that the Taliban took Kabul. And since then, among the many things that have become clear is that the economic consequences are going to be real. And among the challenges is the banking system in that cash-strapped country. Dr. Nafi Chowdhury is a research fellow at the University of Cambridge, and he wrote recently in Foreign Policy about Afghanistan's informal money exchange markets and what they mean in the Afghan economy.
These money exchangers are like miniature banks. They engage in money-related activities such as currency exchanging. They're also depositing money. They're transferring money. They're providing credit in the form of loans to businesses. So we have a network of thousands of money exchangers that operate across Afghanistan. Now, we have to remember that still only about 10 to 20% of the Afghan population is banked. The remaining 80 to 90% are actually unbanked, and so they're going to less formal sources. They're not actually going to banks.
Right. You pointed out in this article in Foreign Policy, the very first line is that the Taliban entered Kabul at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. By 5:30, you say, they had secured the central money exchange. So the Taliban knows how critical these facilities are.
Absolutely. I mean, during the previous reign of the Taliban, they very much relied on the money exchange bazaar. And if there is a decrease in banking activity, which one would very much expect given the instability in the country, money exchangers are going to become very important again in playing an important role to meet financial needs.
So with the banking system in Afghanistan, the formal banking system in Afghanistan a mess, with foreign aid unlikely for the foreseeable future, with the Afghan central bank's assets overseas seized by the United States and Western powers, you write that these money exchange markets, and this is a quote, they are the country's last defense against impending financial disaster.
Uh-huh.
Explain that a little bit.
Yes. The money exchangers are able to operate using their social relations with individuals. And so they're able to grease the economy in the way that banking institutions as well as the government isn't able to. So there's a level of flexibility exchangers can have in providing credit, whereas banks are very much going to shy away from credit given the unpredictability of the country. However, I do also emphasize that money exchangers can't do this alone because they don't create money. Rather, they just make it available and they're able to be flexible in the way that they operate with money.
We've gotten you in Cambridge, in London, just outside London.
Yep.
I imagine, though, you've been on the phone with colleagues and friends and professional contacts in Afghanistan. What's the exchange market like there right now?
It's interesting because there's just very little money in circulation at the moment. These exchangers put their money into banks for safekeeping. And so in these last few weeks, given that the banks have been frozen, it's very much affected exchangers' abilities to carry out their own activities. It doesn't mean that the market has collapsed. It just means the activities have temporarily gone into a lull, and exchangers are now having to be a bit creative in figuring out what are ways in which we can access our funds and what are ways in which we rely on banks and formal institutions moving forward.
One imagines the Afghan economy will stabilize eventually. I wonder, though, what your really educated guess is, right? Because you've been studying this for a long time. What is your sense of how much worse it will get before it stops getting worse, if that makes any sense?
So at least in the coming 6 months to a year, we're going to see a lot of instability in the economy because a lot of funds are going to simply leave the country. And so you're going to see many of the banks are actually going to close down. Then we'll start to see a bit of steadiness in terms of how much exchangers are able to rely on these banks, if at all, and to what extent they now are the only source of credit and also financial services available in the country.
Dr. Nafi Chowdhury of the University of Cambridge, also the Afghan Institute for Strategic Studies, an article he wrote in Foreign Policy about money exchangers in Kabul and Afghanistan. Dr. Chowdhury, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Chinese property conglomerate Evergrande, with which we are all by now, I think, reasonably familiar, had an $84 million bond interest payment due today. And as of this moment, it's not actually clear whether that coupon got paid, which is bad in and of itself, and bad also in a bigger way, because $84 million ain't but a tiny slice of the $300 billion in debt that Evergrande is carrying. Sabri was telling us the other day that American financial markets don't have much direct exposure here. But over in China, that is a whole nother question. Marketplace's Jennifer Pak sent us this from Shanghai.
Evergrande is among the top three property developers in China, and it got there by borrowing a lot. Wang Dan is Hang Seng Bank's chief economist for China.
Many people had believed somehow Evergrande could walk out their debt problem without a huge risk.
Because real estate prices seem to go up endlessly, says Yi Xianrong, another economist. Then came a series of shocks.
Evergrande has 1,300 projects in 280 cities. Most of them are in smaller cities, and sales in these places have been dropping. At the same time, local governments didn't allow housing prices to decrease to attract more buyers.
Meanwhile, Chinese regulators have made it much tougher for developers like Evergrande to borrow. The firm doesn't have enough cash to repay its loans or pay construction workers to finish some 600,000 apartments, and they're already pre-sold. Again, Hang Seng Bank's Wang Dan.
These are housing for about 2 million people. Many of those buyers are just ordinary people who borrowed mortgages and their parents supported or their relatives supported.
Evergrande also owes investors who bought its wealth management products, including its own employees like Liu Yunting. He tells a local TV station he was pressured by the company to invest to keep the firm afloat.
I invested $77,000. My parents and my in-laws together put in $200,000.
Investors and homebuyers have held small protests at Evergrande offices. But this is not a Lehman Brothers-type crisis, says economist Wang Dan.
If the government has to go the extra mile to stabilize a society, in this case, those home buyers, they would totally do so.
Overseas bondholders, though, might be at the bottom of the Chinese government's priorities. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we had no student-to-student transmissions.
That was last year. Now, though, first, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 506 today, 1.4%, 34,764. NASDAQ added 155 points, 1%, 15,052. The S&P 500 tacked on 53 points, about 1.2%, 44,048. Somebody's put a new price tag on that chip shortage affecting the car-making biz. Consulting firm AlixPartners says it will cost the global auto industry $210 billion in lost revenue this year. That is double what was predicted just a couple of months ago. Oil prices reached their highest levels in the last couple of months or so on growing demand, continuing supply constraints. Devon Energy up 7.7%. Now bonds. The price fell. The yield goes up when that happens. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, if you've been listening lately, it's about 1.3%. Today, 1.43% on the 10-year. Not huge, but a jump. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. New York City, to perhaps nobody's surprise, is the biggest and also, not surprisingly, most cutthroat market for app-based food delivery in the country. It's also, as of today, the first city to enact minimum working standards for delivery app workers, rules for both the app companies and the restaurants around pay and delivery zones and mandatory breaks and more. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
One of Andrew Wolf's most frustrating deliveries was picking up food that didn't exist. A customer ordered a seasonal item that the restaurant forgot to take off the menu.
I spent an hour and a half dealing with this, and because the order got canceled, I only got paid $4, I think.
Wolf's regular job is as a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. He worked for delivery apps for research. He says he wanted to call someone for guidance on the missing food, but he didn't have a supervisor because delivery workers are independent contractors.
You know, these companies say, you know, you're free because you don't have a boss, but having a boss actually solves problems.
This is what delivery companies say. People have the freedom to work their own hours or decline orders, though Wolf says there are often penalties for workers who do. The new measures in New York City set standards for delivery distances and minimum payments per order. And they establish fines for businesses that won't let delivery people use their bathrooms. Patricia Campos Medina at Cornell's The Worker Institute says customers are finally realizing that ordering on apps has an impact.
That there's actually a cost for my cheap food, or there's actually a cost for my 24-hour delivery. And workers realize that they have the power to demand more.
And Li Hiao Walpa at the Workers' Justice Project says this is just the start.
This will set example for the rest of the country, but at the same time, will move workers to start mobilizing not only New York City, but across the state.
DoorDash, the largest food delivery company, opposed the measure, but says it will work with New York City officials to identify ways to support delivery workers. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Of the many, by which I mean basically countless things the pandemic has disrupted, education is near the top of the list. Public school education in particular, and it turns out enrollment in public schools specifically. Some families have just chosen other options, homeschooling or private schools. And some research out this week shows that shift has been especially pronounced in the younger grades. In Michigan, kindergarten enrollment in public schools dropped 10% last fall. And as Marketplace's Caroline Champlin reports, it is not just happening in Michigan.
Last fall semester, Kevin Stang was talking to other parents with kids in the Ann Arbor public schools. A lot of them were planning on pulling their kids out. It got him thinking.
I wonder if you can see that in the data, and it turns out you really can.
He's a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan and an author on that working paper. Stang found that statewide, kindergarten enrollment in public schools fell by the thousands. But without those students in the system, it's hard to know where they went. Looking at first graders gave him a clue.
Something like 2% of that group stayed home for homeschool, and that's just a huge increase.
Los Angeles Unified has dealt with similar enrollment challenges, says Jenny Haunts with parent group Speak Up. She's talked with parents considering their options, including one who kept her kindergartner home.
The pandemic gave her an excuse to try homeschooling, and I think she's sticking with it.
She says the pandemic has set a portion of young kids on another path.
I don't know if she'll ever come back to the school system.
Vice President of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, Jim Mason, says growth of homeschooling is the topic of a conference he's sponsoring this week in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah. We're deluged with all these people. And how do we even keep up with it?
Mason says the number of homeschoolers in their network has basically doubled. Now, they're working to keep them there. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
As part of our series about the American labor force, we call it the United States of Work, we have been talking every now and again with Dr. Scott Anzalone. He runs a family medicine practice in Logan, Ohio.
I'm the owner, I'm the employer, I'm the physician, and I'm also the plumber sometimes.
You can add president of the local school board to that list, a job that has become oh so much trickier in this age of COVID and quarantines. With hospitalizations in Hocking County going up and just 40% of the population vaccinated, the Logan Hocking School District has become a very different kind of workplace. So this time, we called Scott's wife instead.
My name is Megan Anzalone, and I am one of two art teachers at Logan High School in Logan, Ohio.
Tell me where we have tracked you down. You're still at school, right?
I am still at school, yep. Our final bell just rang about 10 minutes ago.
How is the day today for you?
It was fine. Things seem to be settling in a little bit.
Well, so tell me more about the settling in, because that kind of implies a little bit of disruption.
It's been a rough start. We actually had, I would say, an incredibly successful year last school year. Hmm. We had no student-to-student transmissions in the whole year last year. But this year we decided to try going back to school without masks and allowing the students to determine if they should wear it or not. So the recommendation was if you've not been vaccinated, you will wear a mask. But of course, that didn't really happen. Yeah. And so we have had just a lot of kids getting sick and a lot of kids getting quarantined, although not sick.
What does that mean for you as a person whose job it is to, in effect, manage the classroom, right, and make sure the kids are on track and doing what they're supposed
right.
to be doing? So how are you doing that now with kids in and out and quarantining and all of that?
Well, all of the teachers are required to have lessons posted on Google Classroom, which is the platform that we use. Mm-hmm. And then the students who are quarantined are allowed to come in on Google Meet if they so choose. But most of them are, you know, just trying to keep up with work at home. So we have to follow the kids in the classroom. We have to supply lessons for the kids that are home. When the kids get back, we have to catch them up on the important stuff that they missed. So it's pretty rough. It's been a bit of an organizational nightmare for everybody, from the administration all the way down to the kids.
I'm sure. So as you try to plan your lessons, that's out the window, right? It's just not possible that you're able to do that.
No, I mean, we're still, you know, we're plugging away here just like we would any other year, but it's just so different. So many kids are behind and, you know, it gets difficult to get caught up. And I know that it's increasing the stress in their life.
Yeah.
So we went back to full masks for everybody in the buildings. But in all honesty, Hocking County is being hit right now harder than we have since the pandemic started.
Yeah. When you go home at the end of the day, your husband's on the school board, as we've told listeners before. What's the dinner table conversation like between you two?
Oh, my goodness. We're both pretty stressed right now. Yeah. His office is getting slammed, and we're getting slammed here, so... Yeah, we sometimes turn the news off, to be perfectly honest.
I hear you. So do I, and it's my job. So, you know, I totally get that. For the kids, right, what is not happening for them because of all this? I mean, give me your, you know, professional – I don't know how long you've been teaching, but I imagine it's been a while. What are they missing?
It's been a while, yeah.
What are they missing?
Well, I'm just seeing increased stress levels in them. They are frustrated. Our whole football team got quarantined at one point. The cheerleaders got quarantined. The volleyball players got quarantined. So they are experiencing anxiety, stress at trying to keep caught up, loss of their activities. And it's very, very frustrating for them just to not be back to normal. I think we all left the school at the end of last spring, thinking we made it. It was a hard year, but we did it. When we come back, it's all going to be better. And it's not. It's not better at all. And so I think that that has been very challenging for all of us.
Are you tired?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My goodness. So tired.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan Anzalone, she's an art teacher in Hocking County Schools in Ohio. Megan, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, no problem.
This final note on the way out today, it's a little bit dorky, but here goes. Congress is still trying to figure out how not to default on our debt. Mitchell was talking about this. The Dems have voted to raise the debt limit. The GOP says no. Here are the numbers just so you have them and you can see how close we are. They are rounded, by the way, just like the Treasury Department does, and we know because we call them. They are rounded to the nearest million. The statutory debt limit in this economy right now, $28,401,463,000,000. As of yesterday, again, according to the Treasury Department, our debt subject to that limit was $28,401,438,000,000. So Janet Yellen, whose job this is, has $25 million to play with. And that explains why she's looking in the proverbial couch cushions for spare change to pay. And once again, because this is important, she needs to pay the debts that we have already run up. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context. It is super quickly because I talked too much today. The macroeconomic number of the day, 351,000. That is the number of first-time claims for unemployment benefits filed last week. If you've been paying attention, you know that's the third week in a row it's gone up, which is not great. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.